Think about how easily things can sometimes unravel, like one canceled flight, and suddenly the whole airport seems to be in chaos. Or maybe one key person leaves a project and everything just grinds to a halt.
Right. Those everyday things, they actually hint at this really fascinating area of study called percolation theory.
Percolation theory.
Yeah, it's basically all about how connected systems behave when, parts of them, maybe the connections, maybe the components themselves start to disappear or fail.
So, like everything from how a meme goes viral to maybe how robust the internet is if a cable gets cut.
Exactly, that kind of thing. And for this deep dive, we've got a really great set of sources that help unpack this theory, especially how it applies to all sorts of networks.
Sounds good.
It might seem a bit abstract at first, but the insights are actually incredibly practical. Helps us understand the world, maybe even design, better, more robust systems.
Okay, so what's our mission today?
Well, the goal is really to pull out the most compelling ideas, maybe make sense of some of the trickier concepts, and just show you how surprisingly relevant percolation theory is, in fields you might not even expect.
All right, let's do it. So, the core idea. Classical percolation on networks. How does that work?
Okay, so picture a network. Could be anything, friends, computers, roads, whatever, things linked together. Now imagine we start randomly removing some of those links, or maybe the nodes themselves. Let's say there's a probability P that any given piece stays, and a 1P chance it gets removed.
Okay, so P is the chance it survives. What happens as we remove more and more stuff? So as 1P gets bigger.
Right, and here's where it gets really interesting. Very often you see the emergence of what's called a giant cluster.
A giant cluster.
Yeah, think of it like a single connected component that suddenly stretches across a really significant portion of the whole network. It disappears. And percolation theory often focuses on precisely this moment when this network-wide connection suddenly pops into existence.
And there's a specific point where this happens.
Yes, that's the crucial concept. The percolation threshold, usually called sub-sub.
Sub-sub.
It's like a tipping point. If the probability P of things staying is above sub-sub, you're likely to get that giant cluster. The network holds together.
But below it.
Below sub-sub, the network tends to just break apart into lots of smaller, isolated islands, no big connected piece.
So this sub-sub value tells you something about how robust the network is.
Exactly. It's a key indicator. If sub-sub is high, it means the network is fragile. You don't need to remove much before it shatters.
Right.
But if sub-sub is low, it suggests it's much more resilient. It can handle more failures.
Okay, so how do we actually figure out this sub-sub or analyze what's happening?
Well, for certain kinds of networks, especially simpler, more idealized ones, like imagine an infinite, perfectly branching tree structure, sometimes called a Bethe lattice.
Okay, a theoretical network.
Right. For those, we can use a method called a branching process. It's a sort of mean field approach.
Mean field,
Yeah.
like looking at the average behavior.
Essentially, yeah. It involves setting up these self-consistent equations. You try to figure out things like R, which is the probability that a link you pick is part of that giant cluster,
Okay.
and S, the probability that a node you pick is part of it.
And these depend on each other somehow.
They do, and you can relate them to the network's structure, specifically its degree distribution, how many connections nodes tend to have using these mathematical tools called generating functions.
Generating functions, I remember those. They sort of package up information about distributions.
Exactly. G sub zero sub x for the degree distribution, G sub sub x for something called the excess degree distribution. They let us make predictions about the whole network based on its local connection patterns.
Clever. Now, our sources mentioned other ways too, something about a Potts model. That sounds like physics.
It is. It comes from statistical physics, studying magnetism. And what's fascinating is there's this deep mathematical connection.
Between networks breaking and magnets.
Now, through something called the Fortuyn-Castellan cluster representation, it basically lets you translate the percolation problem, how these clusters form, into the language of the Potts model, which describes interacting magnetic spins.
Okay.
So by calculating properties of this related magnetic system, like its free energy, we can actually extract percolation properties, things like the size of that giant cluster, S, and the average size of the smaller finite clusters.
And that's useful for complex networks.
Very useful, especially for things like scale-free networks, those ones with a few really highly connected hubs. The Potts model approach can handle them.
Wow. Okay. Using magnet math. to understand network failure. That's pretty cool.
But
what about, you know, real-world networks, the internet, social networks? They aren't perfect trees or lattices.
No, they're not. For those, especially when we have a specific network with a finite size and we know exactly who's connected to whom, what we call the adjacency matrix, simpler methods might not be accurate.
Right.
So often we turn to something called the message passing method. It's an algorithmic approach that helps estimate that critical percolation threshold, sub-sub, on specific real-world network structures.
Okay, so different tools for different jobs. Now, you mentioned phase transitions and critical phenomena earlier. It sounds like this emergence of the giant cluster is a pretty dramatic event.
It absolutely is. It's a classic example of a phase transition, just like water freezing into ice or boiling into steam. There's a sharp change in the system's properties at that critical point, sub-sub.
And around that point, weird things happen.
Yeah.
Critical phenomena.
Right. Near sub-sub, certain quantities start to behave in very specific ways. For instance, that average size of the finite clusters diverges, gets really big. And another measure, the correlation length, which sort of represents how far connections typically reach, also diverges.
And they follow specific mathematical patterns.
Yeah, they typically exhibit power law scaling, so it might grow like pay sub-sub raised to some power, say
wow.
8. These powers are called critical exponents.
Power laws, again, they seem to be everywhere in complex systems.
They really do. And there's this important idea called the universality principle.
Universality, meaning?
It means that these critical exponents, the numbers, like off, often depend only on the fundamental characteristics of the system, like its dimensionality, and not so much on the microscopic details, like the exact lattice structure, or whether we're removing nodes or links.
So the overall geometry dictates the critical behavior?
Largely, yes. But there are exceptions. For instance, in those scale-free networks, the exponent mar, which describes how the size of the giant cluster S grows just above sub-sub, can actually be different depending on whether you're doing site percolation, removing nodes, or bond percolation, removing links. That's not typical universality.
Interesting. So the details can matter sometimes. Now, real networks aren't just random, right? They often have clustering. My friends are likely friends with each other.
Exactly. Triangles and other small loops are common.
And correlations, maybe hubs, tend to connect to other hubs, or maybe they avoid each other. How does percolation deal with that?
Good questions. These features definitely add complexity. For networks that have some clustering, but not too much, we can sometimes modify that branching process method by incorporating the clustering coefficient, C, which measures the density of triangles. This leads to a modified generating function, G sub C 1 sub X, that tries to account for those local loops.
Okay, a little tweak to the math. What if there's lots of clustering, like really tight-knit communities?
That's trickier. One approach is to think differently about the network's components. Maybe you treat those highly clustered groups like triangles or even larger cliques, fully connected subgraphs, as sort of supernodes or superlinks.
Ah, okay. Zoom out a level.
Right. You could map the original network onto a hypernetwork where the nodes are these dense groups. Clique percolation is an example. It looks at how these cliques overlap and connect.
Does that change the transition? Is it still sharp?
Interestingly, with clique percolation, even though you're looking for a giant component of connected cliques, the transition often turns out to be continuous or gradual rather than abrupt.
Huh, okay. And what about those degree correlations? You know, the sortativity, where hubs connect to hubs, versus disassortativity, where hubs connect to low-degree nodes.
Those correlations definitely matter. We analyze them using the joint degree-degree distribution, which tells you the probability of finding a link between nodes of specific degrees.
And how do they affect robustness?
Well, theoretical work, especially on scale-free networks, has shown some perhaps surprising things. Even slight randomness in connections in certain types of scale-free networks can make the percolation threshold sub-sub effectively zero, meaning they're quite fragile in a way.
Fragile even with hubs.
Yes, under certain conditions. Generally, though, assortative mixing hubs connecting to hubs tends to make networks a bit more robust against random failures. Disassortative mixing can sometimes make them fragment more easily, but it really depends on the specifics, like spatial constraints.
Okay, so the mixing pattern matters. Now, we've mostly talked about undirected networks where links go both ways. What about directed networks, like information flow or supply chains?
Percolation theory extends to directed networks too, but things get a bit more complicated. You have to consider in-degree links coming in and out-degree links going out.
Right.
Instead of just one giant cluster, you can have a giant strongly connected component, or GSCC, that's a set of nodes where you can get from any node to any other node within that set following the directed links.
Okay, a core part where everything is reachable internally.
Exactly. And then you also have the giant in component, GAC, all the nodes that can reach the GSCC, and the giant out component, GOC, all the nodes reachable from the GSCC.
So like upstream and downstream of the core.
Precisely. We use self-consistent equations again, involving probabilities like R sub sub and R sub sub related to reaching or being reached from the giant components to figure out when the GSCC emerges.
Any key differences for directed networks?
One interesting finding is that directed scale-free networks can have a non-zero percolation threshold, sub sub zero, even if their degree distribution exponent is greater than 2. In undirected scale-free networks with go between 2 and 3, sub sub is typically 0. So directionality changes that.
Okay, direction really matters. So that covers the basics of classical percolation, but our sources also get into more specific models, calling it dependent percolation. What's different there?
Right. In classical percolation, whether a node or link is on or off is usually just a random independent coin flip. In dependent percolation, the rules for cluster formation are more complex. They might involve iterative processes, or the state of one node depends heavily on its neighbor states.
Okay, give me an example. What's K-core percolation? Sounds like finding the really dense part of a network.
It is. The K-core is the largest subgraph where every node inside it has at least K connections to other nodes within that same subgraph.
Okay, so it's a very internally connected group.
Exactly. So K-core percolation asks, as we randomly remove nodes, when does a giant K-core emerge or disappear?
And how does it behave?
Well, K1 is just standard percolation. K2 is related to something called biconnectivity, how resilient the network is to single node or link removals. But for K values of 3 or more, the transition is often discontinuous.
Discontinuous, like it appears or disappears suddenly.
Exactly, a jump. Not a gradual change like in standard percolation for K1. It's an abrupt transition.
Wow, how do we analyze that?
Again, for tree-like networks, we can use self-consistent equations involving sub-sub, the size of the K-core, and R-sub-sub, the probability a link leads into the K-core. For scale-free networks, the critical exponents describing this transition can be different from classical percolation, and sometimes the transition is even hybrid, partly continuous, partly discontinuous, depending on the moments of the degree distribution.
A hybrid transition, that sounds complex. Okay, what about bootstrap percolation?
Yeah, bootstrap percolation is related but distinct. It's usually thought of as an activation process. You start with some seed nodes that are active. Then an inactive node becomes active if it has at least already active neighbors. It's an iterative process that spreads activation.
Like a domino effect, but you need Dake dominoes to hit you.
Kind of, yeah. It's closely linked to the K core structure and is often used to model things like cascading failures or social contagion, where you need a certain threshold of peer influence.
Interesting. Then there's core percolation or greedy leaf removal. That sounds aggressive.
It is a more aggressive pruning process. You iteratively find nodes with only one connection leaves and remove them and their single neighbor. You keep doing this until no leaves are left.
What's the point of that?
It identifies a different kind of robust core. In tree-like networks, this process actually removes everything. Eventually, finite clusters can't survive this leaf removal.
Oh, okay.
We can analyze it with self-consistent equations, too. An interesting point is that for undirected networks, this core percolation transition is always continuous, gradual. But for directed networks, it can be discontinuous, abrupt.
Continuous versus discontinuous again. It seems like a recurring theme depending on the exact rules.
Okay.
And you mentioned there's a relationship between these different cores.
Yes, there's a hierarchy. The result of an even more sophisticated method called greedy articulation points removal, GAPR, gives a core that's always inside the core you get from greedy leaf removal, GLR, which is also the same size as the biconnected cluster, BCC, in many cases. And all of these are inside the 2 core.
So sub GAPR sub is smaller than or equal to sub BCC sub or sub GLR sub, which is smaller than or equal to sub 2 core sub.
Exactly. They represent nested levels of robustness, and they have different percolation thresholds on, say, random graphs.
Okay, different ways to define the essential part of a network. What about color avoiding percolation? Sounds fun.
It's an interesting twist. Imagine links or nodes have different colors. Two nodes are considered connected in this model only if all paths between them that avoid a specific color remain intact after some percolation process.
Huh. Say it again.
Basically, connectivity depends on avoiding certain colors that might be removed. The critical behavior gets quite complex. It can depend on the number of colors, their frequencies, and for scale-free networks, it can even break those universality classes we talked about.
Breaking universality. Okay. And finally, you mentioned percolation on interdependent or multiplex networks. That seems super relevant today.
Absolutely. This is about systems with multiple network layers. Think power grid and communication network, where nodes in one layer depend on nodes in another layer.
Right. If the communication node fails, the power station it controls might fail too.
Precisely. Failure in one layer can cascade to failures in the other layer and back again. It's an iterative process.
And how does percolation work there?
You look for the emergence of a mutual giant cluster nodes that are part of the giant cluster in all layers they belong to, and whose supporting nodes in other layers are also in their respective giant clusters.
That sounds fragile.
It often is. These systems frequently exhibit abrupt, discontinuous collapses, often described as a hybrid phase transition. Robustness is heavily influenced by the fraction of nodes that depend on other layers, how similar the connected nodes are across layers, like degree correlations between dependent partners, and the overall structure of this network of networks.
And more layers isn't necessarily better.
Often, more layers increase vulnerability. And frighteningly, sometimes even a single initial failure, if it hits a critical dependency link, can trigger a total system collapse.
Wow. That is a stark warning for infrastructure.
Yeah.
Okay, so percolation isn't just about networks falling apart. The sources also say it helps us analyze network structure.
How? Yeah, the concepts are useful lenses. For instance, in networks that are locally tree-like, we can use those generating functions, again, to estimate properties like the average distance between nodes.
Oh.
Then there's K-shell decomposition. It's a method where you iteratively peel away nodes with degree less than K. You start with K1, remove all leaves, then find the one shell. Then you take what's left, remove nodes with degree less than 2 within the remainder, find the 2 shell, and so on.
Like peeling an onion. What does that tell you?
It reveals a hierarchical core structure. The innermost shells, the ones with high K values, often contain the most influential nodes in spreading processes or the structural backbone of the network.
Identifying the core players.
Yeah.
And what about understanding the small world effect, that idea that we're all just a few connections apart?
Percolation ideas help explain that. The average shortest path length in many real networks grows really slowly, maybe logarithmically, with the network size n. That's the small world effect.
Right.
In scale-free networks, it's even more extreme. The hubs act like massive shortcuts, making the average path length grow incredibly slowly, like log n. This is called the ultra-small world property. These properties are tied to how easily connections percolate or spread through the network structure.
So percolation helps explain why 6 degrees of separation might be a thing. Let's circle back to robustness, which we've touched on a lot. How is percolation used directly to measure it?
Well, as we said, it's a fundamental paradigm. The value of the percolation threshold sub-sub is a direct measure, higher sub-sub, less robust.
Right.
And it highlights key differences. Those scale-free networks are famously robust to random node removal. Losing peripheral nodes doesn't hurt much.
Yes.
But they are extremely fragile if you perform a targeted attack and remove the high-degree hub nodes first. That shatters the network much faster.
Because the hubs are the linchpins.
Exactly. We can even model different attack strategies using percolation-like frameworks, like removing nodes with a probability proportional to their degree raised to some power I to see how different networks hold up under various threats.
What about other structural features, like loops or communities?
They matter too. Generally, more loops, higher clustering, better biconnectivity make a network more robust because there are alternative paths if one gets broken.
Makes sense.
And community structure can lead to interesting percolation behavior too, sometimes with multiple transitions as different communities connect up.
And we mentioned degree-ordered percolation, removing nodes by rank.
Yes. Targeting nodes specifically by their degree leads to different critical behaviors and exponents compared to random removal. There are also models for localized attacks where removing a node also damages its immediate neighbors.
Okay. And for those multiplex networks, robustness gets tricky there.
Very tricky. We saw that having a broad degree distribution, usually good for robustness in single networks, can be a disadvantage in interdependent systems because low degree nodes might be critically dependent on nodes in another layer.
The weak link in the dependency chain.
Exactly. And things like intersimilarity, whether high-degree nodes in one layer depend on high-degree nodes in another, become really important for the overall system resilience.
Lots of factors to consider. Finally, for structure, the sources mention using percolation for community detection.
Yes. Algorithms like clique percolation, which we touched on, are explicitly used to find overlapping communities by looking for connected chains of cliques. And more generally, by simulating percolation, removing nodes, and seeing how connectivity changes, we can identify which nodes are most critical for maintaining the network's integrity. Vital node identification.
Okay, great. So structure and robustness. Now, let's shift to dynamics on networks, like epidemic spreading. How does percolation connect there?
It's a really natural connection. Think about an epidemic outbreak, the emergence of a large group of infected individuals who can trace infection back to the source. That's directly analogous to the formation of the giant connected component in percolation.
Ah, the infected cluster is the percolating cluster.
Essentially, yes. We can model different epidemic types. The simple SI model, susceptible infected, where everyone eventually gets sick, percolation relates more to the speed of spread. But for models like KESI, susceptible infected susceptible, where you can recover but become susceptible again, or SIR, susceptible infected recovered, where recovery gives immunity, there's usually an epidemic threshold.
A point where it takes off.
Exactly. For SIs, the threshold sub-sub depends on the infection rate and recovery rate, and it's linked to the network structure, often the largest eigenvalue of the adjacency matrix or the second moment of the degree distribution.
And for SIR?
The SIR model can often be mapped directly onto bond percolation. You can think of the probability that an infected person infects a susceptible neighbor, the transmissibility T, as the probability that the link bond between them is occupied in the percolation sense.
Okay.
So the condition for an epidemic outbreak in SIR is equivalent to the condition for bond percolation on the contact network. There's a critical transmissibility sub-sub related to sub-sub.
So percolation tells us when an epidemic can happen. Does it also help with stopping one, like vaccination?
Absolutely. Random immunization, just vaccinating a random fraction of the population, is mathematically equivalent to site percolation, randomly removing nodes.
Okay, that makes sense.
And percolation theory immediately tells us why targeted strategies are better, especially for heterogeneous networks like scale-free ones.
Targeting the hubs again.
Exactly. Vaccinating the most connected individuals, targeted immunization, is far more effective at raising the percolation threshold, basically breaking the network apart from the disease's perspective, than random vaccination. Percolation analysis helps quantify how much more effective it is.
Even helps analyze things like acquaintance immunization, where you vaccinate friends of random people.
Yes, because that strategy cleverly biases towards finding higher degree individuals without needing global network information. Percolation provides the framework to understand why it works well.
Very cool. Okay, beyond epidemics, what about cascading failures, like power grids going down?
Percolation concepts are definitely used there too. The failure of one component puts stress on others, potentially causing them to fail, triggering a chain reaction.
Like the dependencies we talked about earlier.
Similar idea, yes. Percolation helps model the conditions under which a small, localized failure can cascade and lead to a large-scale, potentially global system collapse. You can find vulnerability thresholds related to network load and capacity, mirroring percolation thresholds.
Makes sense. One failure percolates through the system. The sources also mention traffic and transportation. How does percolation apply to, say, traffic jams?
Think of a city's road network. Roads are links, intersections are nodes. As traffic volume increases, or if there's an accident, a road's capacity effectively drops or gets removed from the efficient network.
Okay.
Percolation analysis can help identify bottleneck roads, the critical links whose removal or congestion would most significantly fragment the network and disrupt overall flow. The transition from free flow to widespread congestion can sometimes resemble a percolation transition.
Has this been used on real cities?
Yes. Studies on cities like Beijing and Shenzhen have used percolation ideas to analyze traffic dynamics and identify critical parts of the road network.
That's practical. What about connected vehicles? Cars talking to each other?
Yeah, for those networks to work effectively, for cars to share traffic info widely, they need to form a connected network. That connectivity depends on vehicle density and communication range.
Ah, so there's a percolation threshold for connectivity.
Exactly. Below a certain density or range, you just have small, isolated groups of connected cars. Above the threshold, a giant component emerges, allowing information to flow across the network, which is crucial for many proposed benefits like traffic smoothing.
So percolation helps determine if the system can even function. And post-disaster scenarios.
Also very relevant. After an earthquake or flood, roads and bridges might be damaged or destroyed. That's like removing nodes and links. Percolation theory is used to assess the remaining connectivity of the transportation network. Can emergency services still reach critical areas? How robust is the remaining network? It helps prioritize repairs and plan response routes. You can model both localized damage near the epicenter and more random failures across the network.
Seems vital for emergency planning. And quickly, you even mentioned evolutionary games. How does percolation fit there?
It's a neat application. In models of cooperation on networks, you often see cooperators surviving or thriving if they form clusters. The formation and stability of these cooperative clusters can be analyzed using percolation concepts. Does cooperation percolate through the network?
Fascinating. From traffic jams to cooperation. Okay, let's start to pull this all together. As we wrap up, what are the main takeaways from this deep dive?
I think the biggest message is just how powerful and versatile percolation theory is as a framework. It gives us a common language and a set of tools to understand phenomena across an incredibly wide range of network systems.
Yeah, structure, robustness, dynamics.
Exactly. It shows how critical the network's structure really is. The connections, the clustering, the correlations, the dependencies, all of that fundamentally shapes how the system behaves, especially how it responds to failures or changes.
And despite all this progress, there are still open questions.
Oh, absolutely. Real-world networks are messy. They have mixtures of all these properties, correlations, clustering, communities, spatial embedding. Understanding the combined effect of all these features on percolation is still a huge challenge.
And going beyond simple links.
Right. The role of higher-order structures, motifs, interactions involving more than two nodes in percolation is another area needing more exploration. Plus, dealing with the inherent randomness and heterogeneity in real networks, like those persistent hubs, still poses interesting theoretical questions.
So the field is definitely not done yet.
Yeah.
Where do you see it heading? What are the exciting future directions?
Well, we'll definitely see continued efforts to refine the theoretical models, making them capture more real-world complexity. But also, a big focus is on developing practical, scalable algorithms based on percolation ideas.
Algorithms for what?
For analyzing the massive network data sets we have now, for predicting vulnerabilities, and maybe even for designing interventions, how to make networks more resilient, or how to better control spreading processes on them.
Well, this has been incredibly insightful. We went from just thinking about connections disappearing to understanding epidemics, traffic, network cores. It's amazing how far this one idea reaches.
It really is. It's a beautiful example of how fairly simple mathematical concepts can unlock deep understanding of complex systems all around us.
So for everyone listening, as you go about your day, maybe think about the networks you interact with, social, technological, biological. How might these percolation principles apply? Where are the potential vulnerabilities? Where are those critical connections holding things together?
And maybe a final thought to ponder. Given what we've learned about the fragility of certain network types, those targeted attacks on scale-free networks or the cascading failures in interdependent systems, how can we actually use this knowledge? How can we proactively design systems, infrastructure, organizations, online platforms to be inherently more robust and resilient right from the start? That's a really crucial challenge for the future.
A perfect question to end on. Thanks so much for joining us on this deep dive into percolation theory. We hope you found it as fascinating as we did.